From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, General Tommy Franks talks about planning and leading the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Franks was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM from July 2000 to July 2003 when he retired from the military. He's written a new memoir called American Soldier. Also, living with the name Bin Laden, we talk with Carmen Bin Laden. Her husband, from whom she is separated, is one of Osama Bin Laden's brothers. Carmen grew up in Switzerland. In her new memoir, she writes about her life with her husband in Saudi Arabia and why she couldn't bear to raise her daughters there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. The House Intelligence Committee heard testimony today from current and former intelligence officials from many agencies. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Republican Chairman Porter Goss of Florida said it is important to be deliberative and act carefully on the recommended intelligence reforms from the 9/11 Commission.
The unintended consequences of action we take could wreak havoc if we get it wrong. So we aren't going to go there. We also have to acknowledge, as many have, that even if we were to act today or tomorrow, we could still be attacked.
The committee's top Democrat, Jane Harman of California, pushed her colleagues, citing the many hearings, panels, and reports in the almost 3 years since the September 11th attacks.
This committee is behind the curve, and we owe it to the 9/11 families and the country to catch up.
The House Intelligence Committee will hold several more rare August hearings in the coming weeks. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
Davenport, Iowa police say there were three bank robberies today at about the same time President Bush and Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry were campaigning in the city within blocks of each other. Police say the first robbery occurred as President Bush was arriving in the Davenport area. The second and third robberies took place while the two candidates were speaking to their respective supporters. Army Private First Class Lindy England was at Fort Bragg today for the second day of her pre-trial hearing. England is accused of abusing detainees at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports from Fort Bragg.
The prosecution is trying to show that England willfully abused prisoners and posed for explicit photographs without any encouragement or direct orders from above. Yesterday, the court heard from investigators who interviewed Lindy England. And today the government has called military officials who lived and worked with her. England's supervisor testified that the Army private's job was purely administrative and that she had no reason to be in Tier 1A of the prison where the abuse is alleged to have taken place. England's roommate, Specialist Felicia Nazelrod, said England was away for long periods of time in the middle of the night. The defense is arguing that England was ordered to soften up prisoners and that she's being used as a scapegoat for what England's lawyers describe as a widespread pattern of abuse. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Hospital officials in the Iraqi city of Mosul say at least 20 people were killed and at least 24 were injured in fighting today between insurgents and Iraqi security forces. The U.S. Army says guerrillas fired a rocket at a police station before attacking the Mosul power plant and a hospital in the city. On Wall Street today, the Dow gained 6 points to close at 10,126 in active trading of over 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 4 points to close at 1855. This is NPR News. The National Human Genome Research Institute has selected the next 18 animals that will have their genomes sequenced. The federal government will fund the research, NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Genome biologists say one of the best ways to learn about how genes evolved is to sequence a variety of different organisms. A range of species have already been sequenced, from viruses and bacteria to humans, but biologists are hungry for more. The 18 new species include 9 mammals, the African elephant, the European common shrew, the European hedgehog, the guinea pig, the lesser hedgehog tenrec, the 9-banded armadillo, the rabbit, the domestic cat, and the orangutan. There are also 9 non-mammalian organisms, including a slime mold, a ciliate, a coanoflagellate, a placozoan, a cnidarian, a snail, 2 roundworms, and the sea lamprey. The sequencing will be done by 5 different centers that are part of the federally funded large-scale sequencing research network. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Daimler Chrysler's Chrysler division announced today that it's recalling about 681,000 minivans. Chrysler says the recall is necessary so a potentially defective power steering component can be replaced. Chrysler says the upper power steering hose on the minivans could leak, and that could result in an engine fire. A Staten Island Ferry assistant captain pleaded guilty today to manslaughter in a crash that killed 11 commuters last fall. Richard Smith entered his plea today at a Brooklyn federal court hearing. He said the day of the crash, he arrived at work with medication in his system. He acknowledged that he passed out at the ship's controls. He said he was unconscious and was not in control of the ferry when it crashed as it was docking on a run from Manhattan. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is General Tommy Franks. He led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as the Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command. He served in that position from July of 2000 until retiring from the military in July 2003. In his new memoir, American Soldier, General Franks writes about planning and executing those wars. He also looks back on his earlier military career, fighting in Vietnam and serving as an assistant division commander during Operations Desert Storm and Desert Shield. General Franks, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your new book that on September 12th you started planning the attack against Afghanistan. How soon did you start planning the attack against Iraq?
The first time that I ever really got serious, and of course I talk about it in the book at some length, was during December 2001. It's always interesting to me that so many people say, well, you know, this president was consumed on the subject of Iraq immediately following 9/11, and I think Dick Clark made that point in his book. And I've told a lot of people that that may be true, but the president of the United States knew who the military commander responsible for Iraq was. And the first time he talked to me about it was the end of December 2001.
What was the reason you were given for invading, you know, for planning an invasion against Iraq?
Actually, the president never asked me whether I thought we should conduct military operations in Iraq. I've always found that interesting because if he had asked me, I would have said, of course, because I was responsible for the young men and women who were flying Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch over Iraq every day for about 10 years. And being shot at almost every day without our country doing anything about it. And so the president, in his earliest conversations with me, made it very clear that his wish was that we should never have American troops in Iraq except by invitation. A lot of people say, well, boy, you're sure a pro-Bush kind of guy. And actually, I am not. I'm actually intently independent. And I'm registered that way, and that's the way I think. But I do make the point that I think a lot of the handling of what Bush thought and what Bush said at certain points in time have been a bit unfair and a bit misleading. And this has been an interesting period in American history, and I did not find the guy overwhelmed with this notion of, well, we just have to hurry up and get in Iraq. I just didn't see it that way.
We went into Iraq without a UN coalition behind us, which we did have during the Gulf War. Do you think that the UN coalition would have helped or hindered militarily? And the reason why I ask that, I remember, I think it was a reporter on our show or policy analyst, I honestly don't remember who said this, who said that he understands that our military often feels it can move better without worrying about coordinating with a lot of other armies. Because other armies do things differently, and it could become a tactical problem to deal with that kind of coordination.
Coalition warfare is tough. I think Winston Churchill, during the dark days of World War II, made the observation that it's actually very difficult to work with allies. That the only thing worse would be to work without allies. I think the issue with regard to the United Nations and NATO, for that matter, is not so much their provision of troops for work inside Iraq or in Afghanistan, but rather how to command and control those forces once they're committed on the ground. Our experience with United Nations command and control, as you know, has not always been for us a rosy experience. One that pops into my mind is Mogadishu, Somalia.
So were you just as happy when you began the war in Iraq that you weren't working with the UN coalition?
I was pleased that we had the coalition that we had. I was pleased with the nations which were involved in our operations in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And actually, I was pleased that we had no overseeing United Nations command and control for the reasons you mentioned.
Those who have interacted with Saddam Hussein say that he was very mentally unstable, that he was a madman. What is it like to go into war believing that the person who is your opponent is mad?
Actually, Saddam Hussein was sufficiently in control of his military to be reckoned with as a commander of that military. And I think we're always not well served to think of the other guy as crazy, if you will. We just need to take a look at the adversary, and we need to treat him in accordance with his ability and not necessarily what we think of his stability.
So were you prepared for particularly kind of crazy or surprising scenarios because of Saddam Hussein and his loss of grasp of reality?
Absolutely. When this plan was being put together, people will ask from time to time, well, why did you use such a small force? Wouldn't we be much better off in terms of stability if we had a larger force on the ground right now? Wouldn't, in fact, we have been much better off had we had a larger force on the ground when we started the combat operation last March? And what I say is exactly the point you made. When you're dealing with a leader like Saddam Hussein, we should always ask ourselves, will this man leave his water infrastructure for the people in place while we build up a force of 500,000 men over 6 months, as we did in 1990? Well, would he leave his oil infrastructure in place, the future of the Iraqi people? Would he launch missiles in the direction of Israel if we were to be very visibly building up for 6 months? And so, for sure, Terry, it's very important to think about the psychology of the enemy, and we did so in this case. And in balance, that's where the decision came from to use the size of force that we had, because we were able to exercise a bit of surprise by going earlier than I think anyone anticipated.
I think perhaps the greatest criticism of the size of the force is about what happened after the official combat part of the operation. Mm-hmm. Critics say that we didn't have enough troops to win the peace, and we're still fighting an insurgency in Iraq. The insurgency continues in spite of the fact that we handed over sovereignty back to the Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And the other criticism was that even earlier on, there weren't enough American troops to maintain law and order, prevent the museums and the office buildings and everything else from being looted, to stop chaos mm-hmm. and crime in the streets, and that the goodwill that perhaps we could have won, for a lot of people, we never won it because of the chaos, because they didn't really feel that their lives were improved, because their lives were in danger from suicide bombings and just, street crime and so on. So in retrospect, do you think that the plan for American troops for the moment after the official fighting started wasn't adequate?
I think that the force structure was just right for the beginning of the operation, and I think beginning about the 1st of May last year, after the president announced that we had reached an endpoint for major combat operations, it was necessary to size up the situation on the ground. It's very interesting. When I started the operation, I kind of had a mental continuum, and on one end of the continuum I saw, well, maybe the Iraqis will wrap their arms around their problem and will create a new Iraq very quickly without a great deal of violence and without a great deal of instability. On the other end of the continuum, maybe we see chaos and looting and continued violence and insurrection and so forth. And of course, Terry, there are a lot of points in between. Actually, when we initiated combat operations, we didn't know which of those two situations we would find. I've often thought how convenient it would be had we been able to find a man like Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan for Iraq. But unfortunately, there just was not such a leader available to do that. We saw what we saw with Ahmed Chalabi, and I think we just simply had to go through the process. And I think our government and certainly our young men and women in uniform have done a good job of adapting to what we have found as we've moved through that.
My guest is General Tommy Franks. He was the Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM from July of 2000 to 2003 and led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. His new memoir is called American Soldier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is retired General Tommy Franks. He led the war in Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq. He was Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM from July of 2000 to July 2003. In Rob Woodward's book about the war in Iraq, he says that that Powell and Cheney were barely speaking to each other during part of the planning of the war. And you write that on far too many occasions, the Washington bureaucracy fought like cats in a sack. You write this in your new book, American Soldier. I'm wondering how that kind of infighting affected you directly.
Boy, that's a great question. I think affecting me directly, not so much at all, affecting the planning that we had ongoing, perhaps not directly, but it was interesting. I didn't personally experience Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld fighting. I actually never saw that, but I did see an inability of the bureaucracies within the State Department and down within the Defense Department. There was not a degree of cooperation that I would like to have seen in evidence as we went through it. These, I think, are huge personalities. These people are patriots to the last man and woman. But each has his own view, and I saw what I thought was a great deal of wedding to own view within our bureaucracy rather than willing cooperation and coordination. Who's to say what overarching effect that may have had? I don't know, but I would like it if our bureaucracy in Washington didn't have so much friction. I'd be quick to point out that I've seen similar friction in large bureaucracies for decades, and I'm not sure that this is an immediate phenomenon. But we do have large personalities in Washington, and frequently they will contend with one another.
And three of the people who you single out for this kind of criticism of being inflexible in their commitment to their own ideas and being disruptive and divisive were mm-hmm. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith. And let me just read something you say about Feith. You say, Feith was a theorist whose ideas were often impractical. Among some uniformed officers in the building, he had a reputation for confusing abstract memoranda with results in the field. Feith was a master of the off-the-wall question that rarely had relevance to operational problems. It was obvious that Don Rumsfeld trusted him, and I wanted to use the products of his intellect, but I had little time or inclination to answer Feith's mind teasers, so I generally ignored his contributions and focused on what the secretary had to say. So, again, what kind of problems did what you perceived as inflexibility ideology have on your work? Did you have to?
What I meant, and what I'll stay with, is many discussions that we would have in defense on problem solving, what assumptions we might make, and so forth. Doug Feith was an out-of-the-box thinker. He is an out-of-the-box thinker, and so we'd be moving along talking about one particular aspect of the plan, and Doug Feith would say, well, how about this, or how about that? And in many cases, it is not that the ideas were necessarily bad ideas. They were just not sequitur with the discussion at hand, and were not practically relevant to the subjects we'd be discussing, and so that's why I made the comment, and I'll stick with it. Doug, nice enough fella, patriot to be sure, but the master of the question that was not necessarily related to what we were talking about.
You described Donald Rumsfeld as demanding and impatient. Norman Schwarzkopf was critical of Rumsfeld and called his micromanagement of the war plan scary in the days during the planning of the war in Iraq. And this is something he told the Washington Post. He said, when Donald Rumsfeld makes his comments, it appears that he disregards the Army, that he is the guy driving the train, and everybody else better fall in line behind him or else. There are guys at the Pentagon who have been involved in operational planning for their entire lives, and for this wisdom, acquired during many operations, wars, schools, for that just to be ignored and in its place have somebody who doesn't have any of the training is of concern. Did you share
that comment, Terry?
Norman Schwarzkopf to the Washington Post.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't share Norm's exact phrasing of the concern, but it's true that Don Rumsfeld is a very direct personality. He's a very direct, hands-on, centralized sort of a manager. Now there are some who take that as disrespect. Disrespect for uniformed leaders who, in fact, have given a great many years of their lives to learn their craft, and they're very, very good at it. And so it is not surprising to me to see people who actually don't know Don Rumsfeld all that well to make the sort of observation that you mentioned. On the other hand, I see him as perhaps one of the most focused men I've ever met. The degree of experience that he has inside the Washington bureaucracy is just enormous. I always respected him. There were times in our relationship where I would have found it hard to think of him as friend, although by and large I did think of him as friend. And he's a friend today, but I joke with people by saying, oh, you mean the smallish, mild-mannered gentleman with the very sharp elbows? And I would even go so far as to say, I think he has done our country a good job over the last several years, which, as you know, Terry, has been a really, really tough time to be inside the Washington bureaucracy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is retired General Tommy Franks. He was the Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM from July 2000 to July 2003. He's written a new memoir called American Soldier. Let's talk a little bit about the actual strategy of the war in Iraq. First of all, you believed in the importance of deception, and one of the deceptions was called the Turkish deception. Would you describe what that was about?
Well, it's very interesting. Part of it having to do with Turkey, but the overarching deception notion was to prevent Saddam Hussein from ever determining where we would launch our major combat operations from. As long as it appeared as though we were going to be bringing major forces down through Turkey, that of course was in our best interest. There was a period, and I mentioned this in the book, where we worked very hard to get Turkey to permit us to bring a large land force down through Turkey. But even when it became obvious that we were not going to receive diplomatic clearance and approval to do that, I wanted to maintain the appearance that we were. And so from time to time, we would pass to Saddam Hussein information that would indicate that the Turks actually were part of a large ruse and at the last minute were going to permit a large American force to come down through Turkey. The purpose of that was to nail down some 13 Iraqi divisions up north of Baghdad. We simply wanted them to remain in place in the north, rather than repositioning themselves down to the south where we would have to fight them. And so that's what the whole deception plan was all about. We wanted to confuse Saddam with respect to when we would attack and how we would attack.
How do you pass misinformation on to Saddam Hussein?
In a variety of ways. I mentioned some names in the book, but we actually used some friends who were heads of state in the Middle East and passed them information, knowing that they would pass some of that information to the regime in Baghdad.
Did they know that they were being used in that way? Were they cooperating, or were they unintentionally sending misinformation?
Very, very, very difficult to say. I think in some cases it was not set up as a double agent sort of approach. In other words, we would not go to one of these leaders and say, "Here's what we want you to pass to Saddam Hussein." We would rather indicate that we were interested in the north, for example, or that we were interested in Jordan to the west, and leave it to them what they would pass to the regime. Perhaps in the future, maybe 10 years, 15, 25 years from now, we'll be able to look back and see exactly what was passed and how it was passed, but that was a part of the approach that we used to keep Saddam guessing.
General Tommy Franks is the former commander-in-chief of CENTCOM. His new memoir is called American Soldier. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. And from Nonsuch Records, featuring Hymns of the 49th Parallel, the new album by Katie Lang, a tribute to Canadian songwriters Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and five others. It's available at Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, living with the bin Laden family in Saudi Arabia. We talk with Carmen bin Laden. Her husband, from whom she is now separated, is one of Osama bin Laden's brothers. And we continue our interview with General Tommy Franks.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with General Tommy Franks. He was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM from July 2000 to July 2003 and led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. His new memoir is called American Soldier. I don't know if you feel like you could share this with us, but I'm wondering what went through your mind on the eve of the war, believing that your troops are going to be facing weapons of mass destruction, most likely biological. It's a terrible fate to be sending troops into, and you thought that that was what lay in store for them. So what goes through your mind right before the war starts?
Terry, that is that's such a good question, and it's an emotional question with me. I think that the hardest thing that anyone in authority ever has to do, and certainly the hardest thing any military leader ever has to do, is send the ones I call the kids. The generals get the credit, and the young people are doing the work. It's been that way all the way back through the greatest generation, the band of brothers, and so forth. When it comes time to make that decision and issue that order, that's a very, very difficult thing. And in my personal case, I just became very introspective. I absolutely believed in the mission that we had been given. I thought it was necessary to conduct this operation in Iraq, and I just steeled myself to the process. I make a point in the book that I learned from an older commander in Vietnam long, long years ago, that sometimes it's necessary to postpone one's emotions until you can afford them.
General Franks, what from your point of view, how did the experiment with embedded journalists work during the Iraq War?
Terry loved it. I loved it. I remember when Tory Clark first mentioned it to me. I said that idea is, in Texas parlance, dumber than a box of rocks. Think about the liability that the military will incur if we embed journalists, and on and on and on. And as I went through that and I thought more about it and I met some of the journalists and I thought about the process, I became the world's greatest fan. And I actually think the embedding of journalists in this operation was just a wonderful success story. On the one hand, you know, military commanders hate it when our citizens see all the warts on war. And war is a warty thing. On the other hand, there is a certain power in having our citizens know the truth. The embedding program was terrific.
Since so many Americans are now reading the September 11th Commission report, I want to ask you a couple of questions about September 11th. You say that on September 11th you were given to believe that there might be up to 30 more attacks on the way. What were you preparing for, and what did you think might happen?
The context of that is actually quite interesting. We had, as has been reported, we'd been concerned for some period of time about a terrorist attack, but actually our concern was in the Middle East. The indicators that we had indicated potential problems in a number of countries for which I was responsible and in which I had 19,000 to 20,000 American troopers under my command. And so at the time that 9/11 happened, and all of the fury of intelligence reporting started and indicating a possibility of additional attacks, my focus was on the Middle East. I was worrying about our American troopers that were over in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and so forth. So that's what we were focused on. At the same time, that I was worrying and thinking about Afghanistan, because I suspected that we were going to go into Afghanistan to remove al-Qaeda.
On September 11th, President Bush was at an elementary school in Texas, and he was in the classroom listening to the children read a book called My Pet Goat, as he was told by Andrew Card, I believe it was, that a second plane had hit the World Trade Center and America was under attack. After getting that message, the president continued to sit for about 7 more minutes as the children continued to read My Pet Goat. What is your reaction to that? Some people have said he froze, that he was needed, that even if it was too soon for him to move anywhere, that he should have gotten on the phone and started to get in touch immediately with his people. So I'm wondering, as a military leader yourself, what was your reaction to that?
Terry, that's tough. I wish that just being candid, I wish we didn't have to have such vitriol, not yours and mine, but when we have election years and that sort of thing, and we find that that an observation like that creates so much discussion. I really don't know what I think about the 7 minutes. I know in my personal case, and in decisions that I have been asked to make or thought it was my duty to make over time, many of them that I have made very, very quickly have turned out to be wrong. And I have found that a little bit of time at the beginning of an issue or the beginning of a problem can pay large dividends in outcomes. And so I can't be in Bush's head while he was receiving that information and knowing what he was thinking about. But despite the fact that that I actually ain't a Republican hack, I don't hold against him that he took some time to do some serious thinking. I think it was a very tough moment for America, and I don't know what I would have done in that position.
You think there's a chance you might have gone back to your seat in the classroom and stayed for a while the kids continue to read?
I actually do. There are a couple of kinds of leadership style. One is the kind that immediately wants to begin issuing instructions, and the other kind is one that has intense confidence and faith in the people right around you. When I was the commander-in-chief, I had security people and operators and intelligence people around me all the time. And in times of crisis, frequently you can just watch them work and satisfy yourself that they are getting the information that needs to be gotten together for good decision-making. And so I don't know exactly what the situation was in that school. I've read an awful lot about it. And of course, Michael Moore's work, Fahrenheit 9/11, and has raised that as an issue. Don't know whether it's an issue or not. I'd have trouble grading someone's paper on that particular point.
Just curious, did you see Michael Moore's movie?
I have not seen it. I've read an awful lot about it and talked to a number of friends, some of whom live right here in New York, about the movie, and I will see it.
Interesting. Tell me why you're going to see it, because I think, you know, a lot of people are some people are refusing to see it.
Oh, I think it's interesting. I find it hard to talk to people who would refuse to see 9/11 or who would refuse to listen to what Rush Limbaugh has to say on an issue. I think far too frequently we want everything to be in hyperbole. And I don't think life is hyperbole. I think while we go through life on somewhat of a sine wave with our highs and with our lows, that reality of life in this country is somewhere in the middle of the scale. And I just like to be advised about what's going on both ends of the extreme.
You each chapter in your memoir, American Soldier, begins with a quote about war, and I want to end the interview with one of those quotes. You quote Sun Tzu, who says, "If you know your enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles." What does that mean to you?
Let me use the example of technologies, and something that people ask me about from time to time, the Powell Doctrine and the use of overwhelming force, and why didn't we do that in Iraq, or for that matter, in Afghanistan. And what I say is, I use the Sun Tzu quote, we have an ability right now to know ourselves, to understand where our troops are, what they're doing, what their levels of supply are, that we have never had before. That is a technologically enhanced capability that simply is just world class. Similarly, the closer we get to understanding what the enemy's capabilities are, then the less fear we need to have in the use of fewer troops in order to accomplish any given mission. So on the one hand, we're technologically capable of knowing our own condition, the friendly condition on a battlefield. But as everything would indicate to all of us, we still have a long way to go to understand the intentions of the enemy. Now, we have a lot of capability to photograph enemy troops and know where those troops are, but we don't yet have the capability to understand their intentions. I think Sun Tzu was talking about that 2,500 years ago, and I think it's just remarkable that it's as true today as it was then.
General Franks, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're the best. Thanks a lot. It's a treat to be with you.
General Tommy Franks is the former commander-in-chief of CENTCOM. His new memoir is called American Soldier. Coming up, Carmen Bin Laden talks about her 9 years in Saudi Arabia. Her husband, from whom she is separated, is one of Osama bin Laden's brothers. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Carmen Bin Laden, lived inside the Bin Laden clan for 9 years, from 1976 to 1985. Her husband, Yeslam, from whom she has been separated since 1988, is one of Osama bin Laden's brothers. Yeslam and Osama have different mothers. Their father had 22 wives. Carmen says that during the years she lived among the bin Ladens, Osama came to exemplify everything that repelled her about that opaque and harsh country. In her new memoir, Inside the Kingdom, she writes about her life in Saudi Arabia and why she couldn't bear to raise her daughters there. In 1985, she moved with her husband and daughters to Switzerland. She was born and raised there, the daughter of a Swiss father and Persian mother. As a girl, she spent summer vacations in Iran. Carmen and Yeslam met in Geneva, and after they got engaged, moved to California, where they both went to college. But he later insisted they move to Saudi Arabia. I asked Carmen bin Laden how many times she met Osama.
I met Osama 3 times, but because Osama would not want to see the wife of his brother, because he was a very strict religious man, and in Saudi society, you don't see the wife of your brother.
So were you covered in a veil when you met?
No, I was playing with Wafa. And
your daughter?
Wafa, my daughter, Wafa, I was playing with her at the entrance, and somebody knocked at the door and asked for my husband. And I instinctively opened the door and find myself face to face with a very tall man who, as soon as he looked at me, because I was unveiled, I had a jeans and a T-shirt on, he turned around and start walking away, and I kept walking after him saying, well, Yeslam is here. And the person who was with him, which was his nephew, told me, this is Osama. Then when he said, this is Osama, I realized. Then I turned back, went inside, called my husband, and went in another room to let him alone with my husband.
So was it shocking to you that your family had a member who was, you know, the world's leading terrorist?
Of course, it's shocking. Every act of terrorism, it's shocking to me. Shocking and difficult because my daughter are having the same name, you know. Then shocking, every act of terrorism, it shocks me.
Now, when you grew up in Switzerland.
Yes.
When you moved with your husband to his home in Saudi Arabia, your freedoms were basically taken away from you. What are some of the things that you could no longer do?
You know, I couldn't go out of the house. Everything that we take for granted in Europe, in Occident, you couldn't do. But, you know, I was still privileged compared to my other sister-in-law because my husband would involve me in what he was doing. I remember even one night he took me at the headquarters of the organization and where everything was closed to show me his offices. Compared to my other sister-in-law, because of my relation with my husband, I had some privilege, you see. But I couldn't drive, I couldn't get out of the house, but I was not the only one. Everybody, all the women used to live this way.
Did you ever say to your husband, if you really loved me, how could you possibly expect me to live like this? To live like a prisoner in my own home?
Because, you know, I did realize that I was privileged compared to the other sister-in-laws. Most of his brother, they would come and discuss business with him. He would let me stay in the room. I was aware that if he went to Bakker house or Salem house, their wife, if they discussed business, their wife would not be allowed to stay in the room. And Jeddah was changing so fast, and it was challenging. And that was one of the things that made Jeddah more bearable. And the other things that you have to keep in mind that when the wealth and the change becomes so, the material wealth, when the Jeddah start building so fast, then I wanted to convince myself, and I thought, I really believed that if the country is changing so fast materially, then morally it will change. At the beginning, the first 5 years, I thought that this difference between Saudi Arabia and the Western world would fade away. Then, with time, I realized, no, they would welcome any material change, but they would never welcome any culture change in their society.
You had many sisters-in-law living in the compound. Did any of them yearn for the kind of freedoms that you wanted, or did they think that you were wrong to even want them?
I know that some of my sister-in-law envied the relation I had with my husband. But what surprised me there, that the worries that I had was not the same worried. I mean, for them, I have the impression that freedom doesn't mean the same thing that it means to me. For me, it was my worries that when my daughter will grow up, or, you know, if something happened to Yeslam, I would be under the tutorship of another male relative. And because my family was not from Saudi Arabia, it would have to be from the Bin Laden family, that my daughter would be under the tutorship of maybe a very strict brother-in-law that would be their uncle. But the woman there, they didn't seem to mind that.
So if something had happened to your husband while you were living in Saudi Arabia, you couldn't have just left the country with your children?
I think it would have been very, very difficult because I would have, you know, they would want the girls to stay in Saudi Arabia, being brought under the Saudi culture, which to be submissive to that culture and to behave like proper Saudi girls. And for me, that was unthinkable. That was one of my main worries, you know. I had that always in the back of my mind, you know, this fear of the future for my daughter.
My guest is Carmen Bin Laden. Her new memoir is called Inside the Kingdom. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Carmen Bin Laden. Her husband, from whom she has been separated since 1988, is one of Osama Bin Laden's brothers. She's written a memoir about her 9 years living with the Bin Laden family. It's called Inside the Kingdom. She now lives in Switzerland, where she was born and raised. You and your husband moved from Saudi Arabia to Geneva in 1985. You were happy to get out so you could get your life back and your freedom back. And he wanted to move because of business reasons?
No, it just happened that he was not feeling well and he decided that he would stay in Geneva. And I decided that, you know, I took that opportunity to enroll the girls at school because I realized that they were growing up and I wanted them to have the kind of freedom that they would not have in Saudi Arabia.
So if this isn't too personal, how did the marriage change when you were in Geneva? Was he comfortable then with you doing all the things that a Western woman would do?
No, I think, you know, the problem was that as long as the girls, they were younger and they were considered as children, Islam would allow me to dress them the way I wanted to educate them the way I wanted to. But slowly, slowly, I did realize as the girls start getting older that up to then, I thought Islam was very westernized. Because he would let me bring up the girl the way I would do it if I was living in Switzerland, you see. Then as the girl started getting in their teenage years, then I realized that he was more Saudi. He was looking at their jeans, you know, that they were too tight, for example. And he started to expect from the girl to behave more like Saudi girls. You see, and I think that was what scared me.
What has it been like for your children to have the Bin Laden name ever since September 11th?
Well, you see, my daughter, they paid a very emotional price before 9/11 because they were Bin Laden. Because we had to fight for their freedom, you see, to be able to live like a Westerner. And 9/11 changed that they were brought up with all the value of the Western world, but with a name that deeply associate with a terror, with culture that is not theirs, then it's very, very difficult.
Have they thought of changing their names? Have you thought of changing your name?
But the truth always catch, you know.
Right, so it would look like you were hiding something.
Exactly.
Well, I know that you and your husband are separated, and I don't know if you talk at all or if you only communicate through attorneys. But after September 11th, did you have an urge to call him and say, you know, it's your brother. It's your brother who was behind this. Like, that's so... I mean, did you have an impulse to just, like, talk to him and kind of share with somebody who understood what it was like to be related in some way to Bin Laden?
No, because I didn't have any contact with my husband. You know, my husband doesn't even acknowledge his daughter when he sees them on the street.
I see.
Because they are too westernized for him, you know.
One of your daughters lives in New York. She went to Columbia Law School.
Yes, she did.
Does she still live in New York?
No, unfortunately not. She lives between Geneva and London.
Oh, because like on September, in 2001, she was living just a few blocks away from the World Trade Center, but she was living with you on September 11th. She was visiting in Geneva.
Yeah, she came for the summer because she had graduated in May from Columbia, and she came at the beginning of June, she came in Geneva, and she was supposed to come back the 15th of September back to New York. But unfortunately, this tragedy happened, and I was advised to keep her in Switzerland.
And so now she's in the position of sending out resumes, I guess, or she was in the position at some point of sending out resumes with the Bin Laden name on it.
Yeah, but I think it's very difficult for the people because to have for a person to hire somebody with that name, and anyhow, that was one of the difficulties, you know.
Right. Does she have a job?
Not yet.
Do you think it's because of the name?
Well, I think at the beginning she had a job offer that were all withdrawn. Then I think it was because of the name, but, you know, we will see what will happen.
Well, Carmen Bin Laden, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carmen Bin Laden's new memoir is called Inside the Kingdom. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from a new CD by pianist and composer Dave Burrell, who we hope will join us soon for a concert. The CD is called Expansion. Here's his version of They Say It's Wonderful.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity on October 3rd, GIC on the web at www.germany.info/unity, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning political columnist Maureen Dowd. Her new book, Bush World, collects her columns from the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.